I don't know whether you've ever met somebody and they say, okay, you got it there? If you've met someone and they say, well, what do you do? Okay, and then you decide, well, I tell them, Gary, I'm in investments. Or Bob says he's in the oil business, or Jack says I was a veterinarian, or, you know, and you're with your association, and then the next question is, but what do you do? And then you say, let's see, now how do I go to the next step? Because they can't, unless they've been in it, they can't envision on a day-to-day basis what you actually do. You know, when you walk into the office in the morning, or you walk in and what do you do with your time? Well, I'm on the phone a lot and I'm talking to investors, or I'm, you know, taking care of whatever. And somehow, unless someone else has been in your shoes, they don't know what you do. I mean, they can't figure it out. And so you try and describe, and that's a little bit like with the navigators. Now, Bill Flinchy is here, and he's one of my handball buddies, and he's in two Bible studies. He's been to Nav World before, and finally one day in the locker room, he said, Jerry, what do you guys really do? You know, it's now I thought I'd been, you know, and I don't preach the navigators when I have my little study on Tuesday mornings. I don't even talk about them. We don't do hardly any advertising. If you go in all the cities in the United States, there may be only two or three, if you look it up in the phone book, that there's the navigators, and one's here. One businessman from San Diego came to me one time, said, you guys are the most secret organization I've ever found in the world. I can't find you. You aren't in the phone book. Nobody says who you are, and our people out in the field, they just go by their names. They don't go by a corporate name. Yeah, it's hard to, yeah. That's another issue. Bob, would you just hold it? No, but.
A donation, it goes into a numbered account.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, that you got a number. Well, that you're personally responsible for, you know, you're in the technological, financial end of things. And, there's stories that Jack and I could tell from way back on when, you maybe don't even remember when NAVs used to write their own receipts, Jack, but you know they used to. And when they went to handling everything centrally, you know, people were a little ticked off, you know, and well, you can't do it. And now, well, that's another issue. By the way, if you've never seen how donations are processed over here, it'd be worth going in sometime. I hadn't seen it for a long time. And just because of saving manpower, they've just got a tremendously good system, an automated system. Well, let me give you some perspective first. Here's what I'm going to do today. I'd like to give you an overview. I'd like to talk about whether we're unique or not. Then I'd like to just give a little historical context. And then I'd like to list a few things that the ordinary staff person out there just does every day, all the time. So, first of all, just perspective. We are, in the scheme of things, we're a small organization. Now, we're one of the larger organizations in the United States working with students and so forth. Crusade and us and InterVarsity and others, you know, we're known as fairly large organizations. But we're just a tiny little part of the body of Christ. And in no way do we think we've got the answer to everything. We've got a particular contribution that we make. And that brings me to the question, are we unique? And the answer is yes and no. But let me talk about the no. And in your little packet here that I've given you, right near the last, is called Navigator Distinctives. And I want to tell you what that is. A friend of mine out in California, and I serve on a board with him, and he said, can you just give me a one-page summary of what the navigators do and who you are? And, you know, why are you unique? That kind of thing. So I sent him a little summary, and I sent the previous two pages to him, plus three or four others. He wrote me back and he said, well, Jerry, that's great. That's kind of from 35,000 feet, but I still don't know what you really do and what makes you unique. And so I wrote him this letter. This was about 2 months ago. And so this is just a letter that I wrote him. And the issue in the second paragraph, we are not really unique. What we do, I hope that every church and believer in the world would do, namely evangelism and discipleship. And I remember the first time I shared this new calling and core values. Just after we developed it, I was over in Hawaii with a group of our NAB staff, not staff, but just, you know, people close to the NABs, and it just fresh off the plate. And one of the guy's mothers was there, and she's in a local church somewhere. Oh, that's exactly what our church does. Now, there's two things. They probably don't. But nevertheless, the sense is, this is what everybody ought to do. So are we unique? And I say, well, no. But we are unique in the sense that we do what those say. And the things I'm going to list are really being done out there. They're not just on paper. Now, is there duplication is another question. And the way I've illustrated it is, let's suppose there's a navigator ministry at the University of Illinois, 50,000 students, or 40,000, or at the University of Washington, in Seattle, where I went. Let's say there are 40,000 students at that university. Now, we as navigators on a given campus can work with 100, and if we've got two or three staff, we might work with a couple hundred. There are 120 in our ministry out at the Air Force Academy today. Okay, that means that there are still 39,000 left to work with. Now, let's suppose there's Campus Crusade, Baptist Student Union, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, in First Presbyterian Church, and all these, they're all working, and they each work with 100. We got 10 organizations working with 100, which I've found is about the upper limit of what you can have on a ministry. I don't know, Jack, what you found, but when they get above 100, it gets a little bit, you don't get individual attention. That leaves 39,000 left to reach. So let's have 10 navigators at the same campus or whatever. See, you see what I mean? It's why is there not just one church in a city? Well, people need smaller environments with which to connect. Now, I'd like to just go through giving you a little bit of a current summary of the NABs. And so if we can get our little system going here, David, I'll bet we... Now, what happened? Did I die here? I probably have to bring the system up again. But so we will. Is it on yet up there? Okay, I know my little system goes to sleep here. So now let's try this again. Aha! Okay, now with great facility, we will do a slideshow. I like that. Okay. Now, one of the key verses that I really like is in Deuteronomy 8. And this is good for an organization or for an individual. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart. Whether or not you would keep his commands, he humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Now, the idea is that God has led every one of us through a journey. And that journey had some deserts, had some difficult times. These weren't fun times. But he says, I want you to remember how I met your needs. The navigators are no different. In 71 years of history, we've had our ups and we've had our downs. We've had our false starts. We've lost ministries here and there. We've done well in some places and we haven't done well in others. And so it's good to review the history just a little bit. He goes on and says, your clothes didn't wear out, your feet did not swell during those 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord your God disciplines you. I want to get my... No, I don't have it here, but that's all right. And so forth. So let me just go on to the next. And then 8 and 9, I'm going to pass up the rest of this passage. But here in verse 13 it says, now, this is when they get into the land. It says, when your herds and flocks grow large, and your silver and gold increase, and all you have is multiplied, then your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Now, I can tell you that today, the navigators are doing well. I am more encouraged than I have been in the 18 years that I have led the work. And I've gone through there were some times I was discouraged. But I can say that, you know, we are seeing things happening today. So I'm very pleased with where we are. But it's not us doing it. So see, to be proud of who the navigators are is something he says you better be careful. Because God is the one who's done it. Now, our beginnings were very, very humble. Dawson Trotman was an ordinary laborer. He did not have a college education. When he came to Christ, he got on fire for God and started working with kids. And so he had the Dunamis Club, and he worked with young people in his church. And he started just devising gimmicks, ways to get the kids to memorize scripture and to study the Bible and to do this and to do that. And then before World War II, he got in touch with some Navy people down in Long Beach area and started ministering to them. But he was a tremendous evangelist. And Doss led a guy to Christ one time. He often picked up hitchhikers. And so he led this guy to Christ. And about a year later, he's coming along this road, and here's a guy hitchhiking, picks him up, led him to Christ, and realized the same guy as he picked up a year ago. He says, something's wrong. What happened? He did not... Here I led him to Christ. He was truly converted, at least seemingly so. But now he's back just where he was. It's like Luis said the other day, you go through this valley times. What is it? And so he started thinking, we need to follow him up. And we need to help him, and we need to encourage him. And so he began developing things like the Beginning with Christ, a little set of Bible study. He called them the B-rations back then because of World War II, and various little Bible studies, various ways of communicating the gospel, various methods of studying the Bible. And at that time, everything, if you want to know why things are the size of those little verse cards, they were to fit in the pocket of a Navy seaman's, that little pocket that they have on their, on a Navy person's shirt. Or blouse, I don't know what they call it in the Navy.
Jacket.
A jacket. What?
Jacket.
It's a jacket, but it's that short one. Yeah, the jumper. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, here's a Navy man. And so he kept devising things. Then World War II broke out. And all of a sudden these navigators that were being trained were scattering out, and he had to train laymen because there weren't chaplains. So these men who had come to know Christ, mainly in the Navy, he was training them. And during World War II, they didn't like these little groups meeting, and they investigated the navigators and said, hey, would you, we investigated you, but you're okay, but would you please incorporate and take a name? So they finally took the name Navigators. And it meant to navigate through life using Jesus Christ as your pilot and the Word of God as your compass or your guide. That's where the name Navigator came. It's a Navy term. And then Doss led the work on through 1956. After World War II, the Navigators almost died. I mean, everybody, we had Bible studies on 1,000 ships and stations around the world at the end of World War II. And really, it really went well. But then all these men and women who come to Christ, they got out of the military, they went to colleges, they went to seminaries. A few stayed around the Navigators. But it was just a tiny little organization of about 30 people. And Doss would give anybody away. Cam Townsend of Wycliffe would call and say, "Doss, we need a guy down in Mexico City." "Great, I'll call somebody." And he calls somebody and says, "Hey, can you pack your bags? You know, Wycliffe needs somebody." And you'll find from that era, Navigator-trained people in all kinds of organizations, whether it was Overseas Crusades or Sudan Interior Mission or Wycliffe Bible Translators, and then even Bill Bright. Bill Bright with Campus Crusade, the first night he was in Los Angeles as a non-believer, he came to Dawson Trotman's house. Someone picked him up. And in one of a recent letter, Vonette wrote and gave all that history. And then when Campus Crusade was beginning, Bill called Doss and said, "Doss, I need some people." And he gave them Leroy Imes and Warren Myers, whose wife Ruth is praying for us, and a couple others, and they went out on campus. And Bill actually helped them learn how to do campus ministry. Now, when I came around the Navigators in the 50s, as a young person, I came into college, and this gets into what we do. I was pretty discouraged because I was just really involved in church. I was doing youth things. I was involved in Youth for Christ, but I felt like a hypocrite. I felt like that facade. And then my roommate had been, who was 2 years older than I am, Ron Ortley, had been helped by the Navs, and he started meeting with me every day, teaching me how to have a quiet time. Then he got me started in scripture memory. Then he got me started just reading the word and getting in it. And every day, we met every day. And I said, "Where'd you learn this?" "Well, this Navigator bunch." And while I was in college, was when Doss died in 1956, and I had a chance to go hear him, didn't. I mean, I was just a freshman. Who's this guy? You know, I didn't go. But the next spring, when Lauren Sani had become president, came, I went. And what I, the only thing I knew about the Navigators, even though I lived in a Navigator home, I couldn't figure out what they did. So here I am telling you what the Navigators do. But I knew they were great people. And the one thing I knew I got was some practical tools as to how to live so I didn't feel like a hypocrite, that I was actually doing something. Well, Doss, they bought this property in 1953, and 3 years later, Doss died. But 1 month before, well, I shared this in the deal. Something happens to me, this is the man. And so we went on, and I'm going to pass these passages on the good news. Oh, by the way, I talked about that time. I just slipped this in. I thought you liked that. Mary, the photograph's a little bad, but it's flaming red here. She doesn't have that now. There's that crew cut that they all talked about. My 37 Chev with a dent in it. And that was our honeymoon deal. I mean, Mary, you had to have four hands and three legs to run that thing on the hills of Seattle. In fact, the whole transmission went out on King Street, or one of those streets that I was on in Seattle. I just rolled it back, went to the junkyard, and got another transmission. But when we go back, the problem is I don't have a 37 Chev. Now, Mary doesn't have red hair. I don't have a crew cut. I'm not that trim. That's a past. Now, I can long for it, and I can have fun thinking about it. This is a different day. We're doing things different, and the same is true with the Navigators. I put one other one in here. That's our son, Steve, but there we were. I want to show that one because Mary was in here. Don't you like her glasses? But there we are at the steps of the chapel at the Air Force Academy, and this is our son, Steve, who died 14 years ago, and two of our three daughters, and we came out there and wanted to see God use us. And I came here partially so I could get training from the Navigators and to get help in my own life. And so I learned by doing when I came out, doing the ministry.
But
What, do you like that? That, by the way, was that's actually a Pendleton jacket. And it's the one that, it was from my college days. We had a quartet. And that's what we wore. Ask Mary about that. We'd practice as we drove in the car on the way, and she's a perfectionist and doesn't like to do things halfway, so that wasn't fun for her. Oops, I'm going the wrong way. Sorry about that. Okay, now let's just take a little picture. I'm going to come back to some more history in a bit. Just to give a little picture, in 1953, there were somewhere near 100 people that were staffed. We did not have a particular focus. The only focus was that we did discipling and a little bit of evangelism. During that time, Billy Graham said, would you come help us? And both Dawson Trotman and Lauren Sanney spent 6 months out of the year training follow-up at the various Graham Crusades. So there's been this close connection with the Graham organization for all of these years. And then, but as far as the Navigators as an organization, there was not a particular focus. 1947, Dick Hillis, who Louis Plow said, we need someone in China. So Doss picks up the telephone, calls Roy Robertson, who was a Navy pilot who'd gotten back into his used car business with his dad down in Texas, says, Roy, we need someone in China. He said, well, how soon? He said, well, how soon can you pack your bags? Well, tomorrow. Great. Be up here. He quit, packed his bag, came up, and within a month he was going to China. And got in there as a single man, and then China closed down in 47, early 48, but he found his wife. They got married, and then and Roy today, the first day on my job in 1986, Roy Robertson at age 65 came into my office. He said, when I went to China, Doss commissioned me and prayed. And the first thing I did as president of the Navigators, he said, would you recommission me to China? And we got down our knees in my little office there and recommissioned Roy. And now, 18 and a half years later, he's still there learning a third and fourth Chinese language, still doing street evangelism in southern China, and still as engaged as ever in his 80s, and still playing tennis, incidentally. So then in about 1973, as we moved into this, Lorne Sanney began saying, we need to develop a ministry with a focus. Why do we exist? And so we started working with students. Then 83, a couple thousand, 93, 3,500, 2002, 38, and we're somewhat over 4,000 now.
When did you become president?
I became president in 1986. But then just to give you a little other picture of just, this is present. Okay. We have in 92, we had about 3,300 staff, but 50 of them were citizens of the developing world. They were the Akoris and the John Mammons. Then in 97, about 3,663. And then 2002, nationalities. This is a number of 50 nationalities, then of 63 nationalities, and of 60 nationalities. And the citizens of the developing world were 727, 953, 1,049. So you see what's happening. We're starting to grow that overseas missionary force. And then in NIAB staff, just to compare, between just 92 and 2002, the number nationalities, and we're now operating in 161 languages. A lot of our staff speak 5 and 6 languages. And then a key issue right now, and a lot of this is summarized in those two pages, but I thought I'd do it visually for you. In 92, we had 22% of our staff were non-American or were cross-cultural, and now 30% of our staff is cross-cultural in this. And part of them are home missionaries, like within India, they're Indians to Indians within the cultures. Or if we send someone into another part of even the United States that's totally cross-cultural, we count that to be the case. So there's home missionaries and foreign missionaries. Nigeria is about 7 or 8 nations, for instance. Am I going the wrong way? There we are. Now, just some key events. The purchase of, by the way, I've made this for the Middle East, so I put Walter and Scott going to the Middle East in 1952, Cyprus, where I'm going to go on Monday. 1953, the purchase of Glen Eyrie. And then Doss died in 56, and Lawrence Sanney began leading the NAVs. And I'm going over to, Alan and I and Mike Trenier are going over to see Lauren this afternoon and to just pray with him, because I know it's pretty serious. I didn't say too much from the platform, but I don't think he's doing well. And so we had a number of other... In 59, we did our first campus ministry. And then in 1960s, we really started sending missionaries, but we sent them indiscriminately. In other words, for instance, when we sent people to Germany and to Norway and to Japan... And other places, we said, well, you don't bother learning the language, just translate it and take the materials from here and translate the materials. And it was a total mistake. And, but it was the way many missions were thinking then. And about half of the number we sent came back. Very discouraged. But I'll tell you, I have gone to all those places, and even though they came back discouraged, they were the foundations of those works. And people still refer to those people who came back thinking they had failed because they gave their lives to people when they were doing it. And then Doug Sparks in the Middle East and Africa, that we opened up other parts of the Middle East in 60. Pardon me, but I'm going to go through these just simply because I've got them for the... we had to evacuate Beirut, move out. I won't go into these things. Just let me press on ahead. And then in 1986, Lawrence Sanney stepped down. My coming into this job was an incredibly surprise to me. I didn't come full time with an NAV until I was 35. Probably Jack was older, but when did you come full time with an NAV?
37.
Well, a little older than I was, but pardon me?
Four kids.
Yeah, that's what we have. We have four kids and leaving our particular careers, and so I felt like a Johnny-come-lately to the full NAV work. And so when in 86 it appeared that I might be a possibility, it just absolutely frightened me to no end, because I just thought it was going to be, you know, Paul Stanley, or it was going to be someone who'd been with the NAVs for a long, long time, and particularly someone who had been overseas, and I hadn't. And we can talk about that if you want. But anyhow, I just, to my surprise, came in there. Then after I came into the job, here's the key thing I saw. We'd been a fairly authoritarian organization, and I said, this is not going to work. And so we went to a concept of the global society and put authority out on the edge and said, we've got to let this work go. And I fully thought we'd lose a country or two with turning it loose like that, and we haven't. We haven't lost any countries at all. And it gave the freedom out on the edges of our ministry. But our whole work, I said, and with my team, by the way, said, it can't work on structure and authority. It has to work because of calling, values, and relationships, partnership, interdependence, mutual respect, and trust. Because I saw things starting to get tense between our Americans and non-Americans. Very definitely, that was developing. Then, and covenantal commitments. We did some other things to develop the work. I'm going to go through these simply because they're structured for the Middle East. In 2001 is when we began developing this calling and core values. And because of its importance, and the way it has developed, I felt free to leave. I feel we're on track and going solidly. But what Neil presented this morning is so important. We've gone now for 2 years on getting the leadership totally committed, but we still have to go to the point of where those leaders know how to bring it out to the grassroots. Because as Jack would know, as Ken knows from having been around us, and Bob, we're a pretty structured organization, and we had a lot of ways of doing things, tools and so forth, that have had to adapt and change, and some concepts we needed to change. And so we're in the process of doing that.
Can I ask what that would be?
Yeah. Yeah, for instance, we in the past used the bridge illustration. It's an illustration of how to come to Christ through the bridge. You got one there, Jack? Here's a bridge illustration, the bridge to life. I use it all the time, but I usually sketch it out. Okay, it's a great tool when people have already been pre-evangelized. Okay, and by pre-evangelized, I mean they've grown up in the Lutheran church like I did, or growing up in this church and that, and they basically knew the gospel, but had never made a personal commitment. But when people haven't had any background at all, then it becomes mumbo jumbo to them. And so when we've gone overseas, and even with some of the college students now, we just had to take longer. So just the tool itself had to be modified. We did that a lot, and we were working with it. Our early Bible studies were question and answer Bible studies. And that didn't work in Europe at all. They thought it was too American, it was too structured, it was too whatever. And so they had to design their own types of studies. Then, for instance, we get down to Kenya or we go into another culture, and the way those Bible studies were constructed was with an American sequential mindset. And this is not the way they would have done it in that sequence. So we just had to change various things. Then like John Ridgway shared, the whole relational component of how do you break in, there were all kinds of things that were happening. Learning the languages, understanding the culture, not importing the NAB songbook and the choruses we sang in Japan. I know, it's heresy, Jack. No, but I mean, and so, well, I'll give you an illustration. I was in one country recently, and one of our elder statesmen was quite upset because he interviewed a college student, and that college student, he said, well, do you know the TMS? And the guy said, huh? He said, what's that? And he was very upset because he didn't know what the topical memory system was. The point was, is he doing scripture memory? Not did he know the topical memory system. But we get married to our past and the way we did things. I still use all those things, but I have to package them differently. So anyhow, in 2004, I announced that I was going to step down, and Mike Trenier, you know all that, has come in. I want to just tell you the challenges we face. I'll go through this pretty quickly. Tribalism and ethnic strife, we've got it everywhere. Militant Islam is affecting us tremendously. Poverty and powerlessness, corruption, economic mismanagement, pluralism, relativism, and nominal Christianity in the United States is one of our greatest enemies. People think they know Christ because they're religious. I mean, you even look at the political environment and the way, well, if you're right-wing Republican, then you must be a believer, or if you're a believer, you must be right. You know, it just gets all confused. And we're operating in all those countries in the 1040 window. We access now by an authentic presence because many of our people are going in professions. Now, in access to the hearts of people, we talk about incarnation, hard places of the world. You can either have a cover story, that is, I have a card that says I sell whatever, but I don't really. I never sell anything, but I just go there. We did that in Central Europe and Russia a lot. And we found it wasn't too effective because the people couldn't repeat it. They had to have real jobs. And so the pattern didn't work. Or we have a valid identity, people going in their profession, and an authentic presence. And I'm going to pass on that. There are the countries where we are not right now. We still are going in. Now, we're going to get into Algeria. We're ready to go into Iraq. We've got teams that are there. Mozambique is being looked at right now. The Koreans are ready to go the minute that thing opens up in North Korea, and so forth. But those are where we're going to go in the future. Now, here is sending
Jim,
in the...
Can I tell you something about North Korea?
Yeah.
When I was stationed in Korea, the Presbyterian missionaries told us that the North Koreans were the most spiritual. The South Koreans were the lazy, no goods.
Oh, is that right?
And they had more... The Presbyterians had more churches in North Korea before the division.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. I want to back up and show you this again. This is the sending, and notice all the yellow lines are Americans. And that was Joe Simmons going from England to New Zealand. This was in the 50s. And then in the 60s, again, it's predominantly America, but then starting to get a few non-Americans in the purple. But we slowed it down. Lauren Sandy in the 60s says, we're going to stop, figure out what we really do, what is our contribution, and stop sending indiscriminately. And then in the, went the wrong way, sorry. And then in the 70s, again, we started picking up the sending tremendously, and you'll notice the increase of non-Americans going other places. And then in the 80s, it'll start just getting more, I can't put it all on one slide. This is just what we did. You'll notice again the increase of the non-American component, and then in the 90s. I haven't done, we haven't done the 2000, but look at how that's changing. See, now that gives the picture of what we're doing. Our concept is that what we do ought to be done by ordinary people in their language and in their culture, whether that's in America or in Korea or wherever it may be. Now, I'm going to stop there for a little bit. I'm going to leave that calling up. But let me just talk about what we actually do. You say, okay, here is ordinary Joe Navigator representative. He may be located at Oregon State University or at Purdue University or on a military base or in a city in the barrios of New York or working amongst Hispanics in Albuquerque or wherever it would be. They basically all do the same thing. And that's why the Navigator ministry gets very boring sometimes. And it's very repetitive because what we do is evangelism and follow-up. When I first came to the Air Force Academy, for the first 2 years, all I did was evangelism and follow-up. And what I would do is in all kinds of contexts, have little Bible studies, I would be at little retreats that we would be at, whatever it is, to be able to share the gospel with people, to make the gospel clear, and to help them come to a point of commitment. So that's what I mean by evangelism. Now, we don't try and convert them to the Navigators or convert them out of Lutheranism or convert them anything. All we want them to do is to look at the scriptures and to figure out who Jesus is and what do I do about it. Okay, so I do that every Tuesday morning here with a group of handball players. Now, they can't read, so, you know, it's a, got a little problem there. But anyhow, that's what we do. We do evangelism. And then when they have made this commitment to come to Christ, then we really start working with them and following them up and meeting with them on a regular basis and helping them get depth. So yesterday, Thursday morning, I'm at Starbucks up here with a young guy who's an academy grad, 10 years out, came to Christ through the influence of another handball player, and he's now working for an engineering firm here. I took him down to my Tuesday study when I found out he'd already come to Christ. And he didn't like that for some reason. I said, okay. And then I showed him about three or four Bible studies. He didn't like any of them. And we finally, you know, because, see, he's a young person, and he's trying to figure out what fits him. And so we finally found one that he, I showed him the lessons on assurance and that, and he didn't want to do it. It's kind of like, you know, you've got a baby that doesn't want to eat certain kinds of stuff. And so I said, okay, here's what we'll do, but you got to do one other thing. And I gave him the lessons on assurance, lessons in Christian living. I said, we won't do the lessons, but you've got to do the scripture memory. Okay. So he rips out these verses. And now scripture memory is great to him. He's doing, and I forgot to check him on his verses on Thursday, but we were kind of rushed. I had to get back out here. But he's excited. He is seeing new things in the scriptures. We're going, and every study, like we did Thursday, we're doing a thing on parenting this time because he's got three little kids. And so we were in Proverbs with this little study guide. And man, he said, oh, what was that? Okay, let me write that one down. He underlines it and he does this. And all I'm doing is I'm just facilitating his coming to know the Lord better. And then I say, now what are you reading every day? And so I encourage him to do that. And by the way, the studies have to be written. It's not just kind of out of the head. So in the little booklet that I'm using with him, we both have to write down our answers. And because that keeps an accountability. So that forces, so he not only does it ahead of time, but then when we're together, we do more of it together. And then he interacts, and then we do a little scripture memory, and then we talk about prayer, and we get updated on what's actually happening in his life. He sent me an email last night. I sent him to the same physical therapist I'm using because his shoulder's giving him problems, and that physical therapist is a new believer and coming, walking along. So every time I'm with him for physical therapy, we're talking about spiritual issues. And he sees that this whole thing is just part of the way I walk with God. The way I raise my kids, the way I treat my wife, the way I do my work. Thursday we talked about his interviewing kids, young interns from UCCS to come in and work with him. He's interviewing new, and what do you look for? Well, you look for character. And so it's all integrated. So what am I doing? I'm doing evangelism and follow up. Those are the two things. And when we have a guy around on campus, that's what I want them doing all of. That they are out with lost people, people who don't know the Lord. And there are more and more of those who recognize themselves as lost people. They're not just quasi-Christians like many of us, you know, who are kind of growing up with a religious background. Then you get in the Muslim world or the Hindu world, and there's no question. It just, the evangelism part takes a lot longer. We do two kinds of evangelism. One is confrontational or proclamational evangelism, that you just tell them. You know, sure, you give the bridge illustration, you go through it. And the other thing, you do relational evangelism, be with them over a longer period of time. Okay, the second thing we do, and this is probably the strongest thing, and that is we disciple in depth. That is, just because they've got assurance of salvation, just because they are kind of going along okay, then we start getting them deeper into the scriptures and challenging what's happening to your character. How do you live your job? How are you treating your wife? And then, are you digging into the scriptures on a regular basis? So tomorrow night I'll have a Bible study. Okay, this Bible study has five other couples in it. Except for one of the couples, none of them have done in-depth, well, maybe two have done in-depth Bible study before. And I tell you what we're going to start studying tomorrow night. You'll say, yeah, that's deep. Daniel is what we're starting tomorrow night. But we've done other things. That's what they wanted to do. So I said, okay, we'll work on it. And I'll teach them how to do some in-depth things. Now, Mary and I say we're not doing a very good job. And one of the things about stepping out of this job, we're hoping I'll have a little more time to do what I consider to be in-depth discipleship with these people. I know them all well. Four out of the five of them are academy grads. There's a doctor, there's a top key insurance agent here in town. Another guy was the chief of staff for the Air Force Academy, and another, and so on. But I need to spend time with them on a personal basis, walking through and helping them disciple so that they can disciple someone else. Now that's what this next item is, number C, is generational ministry. The most distinctive thing about the Navigators is we do not feel our job is done till someone we are working with leads someone else to Christ and then starts helping them. Okay, so my buddy Mike, on Thursday, we've got a guy down at the Y, and we talk about him and some of the other guys. This guy's a former professional baseball pitcher with, I don't know, from Dallas, so I think he was with the Dallas team. And he hits the handball like a rocket. But on the side, we know he says, can you imagine? Jerry White, he's got a PhD, and, you know, he was in the Air Force, and he's smart, and he believes all this junk. He said, can you believe? And we know that. We hear it coming around, you see. Okay, but he still is our friend, and Mike's the only one that can beat him. I can't touch him. And Mike, and we said, okay, one of these times now, it's going to open up with him that he'll be able to share the gospel with him. And that's the way it is with our friends that we're working with. So I'm working with Mike to help him share the gospel. Another young guy that I'm meeting with just came this noon. He's the son of John and Nancy Ball, who are in the conference here, but I'm meeting with him, and I'll meet with him after lunch today, and we'll go over scripture memory. We're going to go over a little Bible study I've got him doing. We're talking about the job that he's just gone into. He just took last week in Denver. And, you know, just all those issues. But eventually I'll want Matt to think, okay, now, how do I start reaching out to my friends and helping them? Now, you notice at no point have I said I need to invite them to church. Now, I'm very involved in my church, but none of my Tuesday morning study ever go to my church. And if I invite them, they wouldn't come. I mean, they wouldn't. I mean, that's not their world. They have no interest. And I'd like them to, but they don't. But what I'm trying to do is to help them get this on a personal level. So man-to-man and small group level. So if you look at A, B, and C, any navigator, if you walked up to him and says, tell me about your evangelism, tell me about your follow-up, tell me about your discipling, and tell me who's in the third and fourth generations in your ministry, and you'll know whether they're doing the navigator work. That's all there is to it. Now, and we do it with anybody. So we're working with churches. And the churches want to know how to get their people to grow in discipleship. We go through exactly the same thing. First, we get them helping to reach the people they don't know Christ, following them up, discipling them, and thinking third generation. I don't know that as simply as I can put it, that's what we do. Now, it becomes a little more complicated when you go into what we call the frontiers. And that is into China, into the Muslim world, into the African world. And there you've got to contextualize it. As in Africa, you can lead person to Christ again and again and again and again and again, because they're very responsive to the gospel. But what's needed in Africa is the depth. Now, you look at Akori. I know you heard this morning how many verses he quoted. And when he was being discipled by Mike and Bob Tossig and those guys over there, let me tell you, they learned how to memorize the word and dig into the word. I mean, I got some things that he saw in that scripture today that I hadn't thought about. You know, Akori is just an ordinary air traffic controller who came to know Christ, and our guys discipled him. I mean, he didn't finish his college. In fact, he just did recently. He got a master's degree here recently in a U.S. university. But they know the word. But he's got to do it differently in Nigeria than you do in the United States, and certainly different in China. And certainly, now Japan's very tough. That's, our ministries there have been very hard. Alan Moni Miyashita, I never pronounce her name correctly. You saw them?
Miyashita,
thanks, Jack. They are fruit of our ministry in Boulder, and they've had two with IBM. They've been twice in Japan. And, you know, they've really, they know how to do it. They know how to relate in the Japanese context. I don't. That's what I mean by contextual.
And they are intentional in their outreach. They're very exciting to talk to.
Yeah. I mean, they're in a church and they're doing things up in with IBM in New Jersey. And, you know. So one more thing, and then I can talk about lessons we've learned. But E, I put distinctive foundation and means. Now, what I've done in that little letter, which I thought I'd just include, if you just turn to that for a minute, I'm just going to mention the bullets, and then we'll have about 20 minutes here to talk about it, and you all to correct me, you know, Dave, who's been doing it for all his life, too. Okay, our hallmark is person-to-person, in-depth discipleship, one person discipling another. It's not occasional coaching. It's intentional and regular. Does that ring a bell, Jack? You know, I mean, that's what we do, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we want to equip people with the tools to do this on a lifelong basis. Bullet two, deep commitment to third-generation discipling, 2 Timothy 2:2. The third, emphasis on evangelism is shared with many, but we add to it this element of discipleship and going into the hard places, the Hindu, the Muslim, the Buddhist. And we're committed to the hard places and in-depth personal Bible study. Now, I've got a lot, I've got more in here. I think on the next page, the second page, is an important thing. As an organization, we're committed to the proposition that the ordinary layman can and should do the work of God. And our task is to equip that layman to have a deep impact on his or her world without ever becoming staff of the Navigators or anything else. And then we're very intent on training future leaders. When he mentioned 200 this morning, that's not a wag number. I've got the names of those people. I mean, their name. We know it. We know exactly who are going to come to those leader development seminars or times together, and we also know what's going to happen. Okay. So that's what we do.
I got a chance to appreciate something you're talking here. The last point, the church has been influenced. Mm-hmm. I was asking about how many of them have been influenced by mass evangelism and things like this. And I asked him, I said, well, how many of you have been influenced in your walk with God by the Navigators, in whole or in part? And about 60% of them.
About 60% did.
This is 1,500 people.
Yeah. Do you remember that Luis Palau this morning said I was in this big congress in the Philippines? Well, that was the World Congress on Evangelism, and I was there, and Ford Madison was there. We had 200 to 300 third world, first world, pastors, missionaries, grassroots people sitting in there. And he asked, how many of you came to Christ through mass evangelism? 3 or 4 did. How many of you came to Christ in a church? A few. How many of you were led to Christ, or were led to Christ by a pastor or an evangelist? Just a few. How many of you were led to Christ by another ordinary layman, a businessman or someone like that? And about 90% raised their hands. I mean, if you look at evangelism, it's person to person. Immediately. I mean, but I don't necessarily take them to mine.
Right.
They intuitively know that they need some fellowship. And so it always comes up in a conversation. And so I just kind of keep track of what they're doing. For instance, this my buddy Mike that I met with Thursday. I got him down to our house on, actually it's my daughter's. I wanted to meet my daughter and son-in-law, because they're about the same class at the academy, and to connect, and they immediately started talking, well, we're still looking for a church, and we've been there, and maybe they're going to do this, but it just comes about. But what I do not want to communicate is that is what will make you, you know, that's a little sure, this kind of final step in becoming a believer, that they go because they want to be fed, or why they go, and we talk about it, yeah, it's just... It's an open conversation.
Jeremy, you'll get into this share a little bit about the funding and the financing that helps you do this?
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention that. Yeah. How are we financed? Every staff member in the Navigator raises their own support. Every staff member raises their own support, including me. Because when I came in this job, I said, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if Jack and those guys out there have to raise their own financial support from individual donors and churches, then I do. So I have about, 70, 80 friends who support me and have for years and years and years. Every one of our staff has the same. About 10% of our donations come from churches who give to an individual staff member. So every staff has that, and out in our field staff, they get what comes in. They may not get a full salary. The second thing is we do some organizational fundraising like we're doing here for special events, like we do for Glen Eyrie. We're trying to raise an endowment for Glen Eyrie for the maintenance of it, or to do special projects. Or the Africa Partners help raise some for some events going on in Africa. And we do some other corporate fundraising. Obviously, you have to do some, but it's a very small portion of the total. Of about, in the U.S., our budget worldwide is, you can't really tell what our budget is worldwide, by the way, because of exchange rates not being meaningful. But it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 120, and I'll give you a pretty wide span, to 150 million. The U.S. is, actual income is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 80 million, 80 to 90 million. But that's made up of little tiny pieces. Individual donors who give, and that's how the entire work is supported. Churches tend not to give to, quote, the Navigators. Churches don't. They give to John and Mary, who are serving at Purdue University. They give to Jerry and Mary, who serve as international president, or whatever I am now. Okay, so Wooddale Church. I got one from the Dorcas Society just the other day. Anybody know what the Dorcas Society is? You do if you're Lutheran. Yeah. The ladies' group in the Lutheran Church. So my little church, Stavanger Lutheran Church in Garden City, Iowa, with less than 100 people in it. The Dorcas Society, every once in a while, gets some money together, and they don't know how to write it out, so they wrote it out to me, but I said, I don't think you meant it to come to me. You wanted to go to the Navigators for my ministry. But Dorcas Society would never send anything to the Navigators. They only sent it to little Jerry, who they remember growing up around Garden City, Iowa. And where my folks went to church up in Longmont, Colorado, when they came to Christ, Grace Evangelical Free, they support us a little bit. But the church, they wouldn't support the Navigators as an organization. They support individuals. So therefore, what we're doing like here, we'll raise some money for these leader gatherings because from people who will give more in proportion to the need and or to do other of the larger project
ideas. You don't
ideas.
Do grant writing or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, we do. We go for grants. I serve on a foundation, and there'll be grants, another foundation. We have the Horizons Foundation. There are grants. We've made an appeal to one other foundation for part of this leader gathering thing, which you guys will know, the stewardship up there. And the stewardship's been, when Dave Weyerhaeuser was alive, I knew him pretty well, and he supported Young Life and the Navigators, basically. And so we do some, but foundations even so, we don't do flash projects. We don't try and blow it up into something bigger than what it is. And so we, nor if a foundation says, well, we want a ROI, return on investment, how many converts, how many this, we say, we're probably not the organization you need to work with. Because we don't do that kind, we don't say, well, for every dollar you give, there'll be 12 presentations of the gospel to Hindus in India. Because that's not the way we function. Now, if you want to go out and see whether we're really doing what we say, that's great. And you'll see, if you get on the grassroots, you'll know that it's money well spent. But we don't collect those kinds of statistics. We used to, but...
A friend of mine took me to breakfast one morning, and he was very involved in a return on investment, a couple of organizations. And we were leading a Bible study at home. But he wanted to know more about what we did. So we went to breakfast that morning, and he said, well, we'll consider supporting you guys, but I want to have breakfast and find out what you do. So he said, we were talking about evangelism, and I was still doing the military. And I said, well, you know, we see these kids come to Christ real quick, being singles out there. But I said, the largest part of what we do is with couples. And he said, how long does it take you to disciple a couple? And I said, 2 to 5 years. He said, that's too long. That was the end of the discussion. It quit right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because he just thought it ought to be...
You got to do it right away.
Yeah.
You know, the way...
Tell me that when I talked to him about discipleship training in his church, he said, if it's longer than 6 months, I'm not interested.
Yeah. See, this is...
I've been discipling a couple now for, what, 7 years?
Yeah. See, what the way I like to describe it is we are building for the long haul.
Yes.
Let me give you a story. Ken would love this, being an Air Force Academy graduate. Of course, he can't remember now when he graduated, if I, right? Too old to, okay? Okay, class of 74. What class were you?
63.
Oh, you're old. 74 came together. 350 students came out to the reunion, including their wives. There were 60. There were 60 that came to a little gathering of people who had become connected with the NAS and believers. Now, 60 out of the 350. I went to that gathering and listened to all of them. Over half of them had come to Christ after they left the Air Force Academy through the witness of the people that were there. Then the more remarkable thing, I was running the ministry when those kids were freshmen. Of all those 60, only one of them had I prayed with to come to Christ. All the rest had been led by people that we were helping grow, you know, that had come to Christ the year before, were the seniors or whatever. And not, they didn't stop there. They've been doing it now for 30 years. And you listen to the stories. And I said, that is generational investment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ken.
Jerry, one other thing, I think you should mention how you covered the administrative
costs. Oh. Yeah, no. On every dollar given, there's a 10.4 administrative cost, which is very low. I've seen all the ratings. You got to say, what do you cover in administration? That is true administration. It's the receipting, the accounting, the IRS forms, the taking care of just the business. There is no leadership charge. So Alan Andrews and his team, and I and my team, we all raise funds separately, and it's a significant thing to do. You know, Bob's been involved in our, you know, our office support for a long time, and various others have in this conference as part of our way of saying thank you is having this conference. And I think that's going to have to change. We haven't changed the 10.4 for almost 10 years, something like that. But nevertheless, so that's what we do. NAB Press is just a ministry. NAB Press, we have them pour their profits back into their, if they make any profits, back into themselves. And we ask them to make $100,000, something like that, contribution per year to the U.S. Navigators out of their profits. We ask them to plan that, and we're going to forgive it this year because there's a little thing happened. There was an accounting situation. The message didn't produce, and so we're probably going to, if you look at the publishing industry, there are only three publishers now that are independent. All the rest are owned by mega corporations. One is ours, the second is Moody Press, and the third is InterVarsity Press. Now, I think there may be a couple, three others, but basically, and then we only publish things that relate to our mission, vision, and goals, so they can't go and you know, when Michael Douglas comes to Christ and write up his story or something, whatever, you know, we don't do stuff like that. We keep them focused. It's what we call a captive publisher to a vision. And And so NAB Press does not essentially, they contribute to our public image. Most people who know the Navigators know us through NAB Press. We don't do any publicity to amount to anything. You don't find us in Christianity Today as the Navigators. We have websites. We've got a lot of them now. But the first month we brought up our website, we had 40,000 hits from the Middle East. And we were scared. I mean, this was not. Fortunately now, there are a whole bunch of our countries that got them. It gets them very confused now so that they'll go into Navigators and unless you know what you're looking for, it will. But our staff are very vulnerable, so therefore we don't publish the countries we're in. We don't publish a lot of things out on the web just to protect our people.
I wondered why you weren't on the web, because we went on trying to find. I remember when we first met Jack and Cynthia.
Yeah.
I was using Cynthia's books, and I couldn't find her anywhere.
How long ago was that?
5 years ago.
Yeah, we're on there, and there's Navigators. There's Navigators of Canada, Navigators of Kenya, then Navigators.org, and you can find it now, and it'll lead you into certain things like church discipleship ministries, military ministries, student ministries, which we had to give up. I mean, we tried to. I mean, it's like saying I'm going to drive a horse and buggy no matter what jet airplanes there are. You have to go with the web. But it is risky to our people. If you notice, if any of you ever write me, you'll notice I don't even have a Navigator's organizational address. Mm-hmm. So I can...
Imagine Jack can be listed as Nav's Texas Aggies or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Ken, you're doing discipling down there with some cadets down in Florida. I mean, is this what you've experienced?
Yeah. All I'm doing is just doing what people did to me. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
Do what somebody did to me because it worked with me.
Yeah. And that's basically what we do. Yeah.
I just encourage kids to grow. And nobody reads the Bible anymore, so it's kind of fun to get somebody actually where they are.
Yeah. That's why I'm using your book, John. John's done a book on the basic fundamentals. I've got to get a book that someone will read. And his is readable on a summary of, give me the foundation. Yeah, and you read through, and it's readable, and so I use it to orient people on the Bible. Read.
How do you manage the relationship between the U.S. NAVs and the international?
Oh,
they look so totally independent.
Well, they aren't. I have an international team where we have representatives of all the regions, and the U.S. is one of the regions. And it's 50% of the work, about 70 to 75% of the finances. But because of Alan Andrews and the U.S., and I'm also chairman of the U.S. board, that helps a little bit in the sense of balancing it out. That the U.S. really serves the rest of the work, doesn't run it, and it's a tremendously good relationship. My problem now in the future is going to be that people won't know enough about the U.S. from around the world. And within 3 years, there will only be one American on this international executive team. It'll be Neil Grindheim.
In 3 years, just one?
Well, it'll be just one. See, right now you've got Paul Stanley. You had Paul Stanley, I, and Neil. Okay. Paul's going to slip off in a couple of years because he wants to do more leadership development. And you're bringing on a New Zealander, you've got two British, you've got Esther, and you'll have Neil being the only American. I call him a semi-American because he's lived out. And so I've talked to Alan and them, and we need to make sure that we keep some key Americans at the top of our leadership. Now, in the past, it was the other way around. The rest of the world says, gee, they're all Americans. But now we're going, but it's great. But it's a good question, Reed, because there have been tensions in the past.
Well, we see you got two headquarters buildings.
Yeah, and the only reason for, it would be no problem for me to have an office over in the U.S., but the non-Americans would not like it. They want to see us distinct. We could have this building in Singapore. Then you have the confusion with the Singapore Navigators. So there we could have it in England. Then you have the confusion with the British NAVs. But we keep the international, and then Allen reports to the international president. The U.S. reports to the international president, which is the only, one other organization that where that is the case.
So. One of the international guys say he's glad to see the two headquarters type things because he feels like the navigators have an interest in what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's not just an add-on to the American.
Yeah, it's very, very important. That building, if you haven't gone by, is very, it was an important aspect. I determined before I leave the job, we needed to do that. We needed to have something that was distinctly related. Also, I wanted to keep the international headquarters in the United States.
Well, it's, I understand where you're coming from, because I asked Jerry this a long time ago. I said, what's the deal of having the two presidents, et cetera? Because as a veterinarian, anything with two heads is a monster.
Yeah.
I wanted to know how is this working?
Yeah. But there aren't two heads, and that's what we figured out. You know, the international president is the leader, and we're doing a lot of things to. But now, Gary, let me ask you and Catherine. You're part of why this was. Did this help?
It really did, Jerry. And this is our fourth conference, and every little bit, I'm glad to hear that. This is a lifetime growing experience.
Yeah.
This really good.
Plus, you've got a lot more information, general information, just for the people at the conference.
Yeah.
Just in the last day and a half, and I remember
that. Yeah. Well, we always try to do a good job. By the way, the reason we have two presidents' conferences, one focusing on the U.S. and one in the international, is pretty simple. We are trying to do both in one conference. You can imagine how confusing that was to talk about the metro ministries, the African American, the Hispanic, the collegiate in the U.S. and the military in the U.S. and the community and the business. You know, it just confused. Talk about confusion. Then you talk about Kenya, and so we said let's have one that focuses on international, one that focuses on what's in the U.S., and that's the one in February.
Do you still have summer conferences?
Not as much. No, and that's that initiative. There are some, yes, Bob, but they're sponsored by the regions. It's a thing that has passed. That isn't, there used to be that Nebraska and Oklahoma and Texas and California and everybody would all have a week at the Glen and they'd bring all their contacts here. But number one, there are a lot of conference centers out there, and so why go to this one? It's a long way to go. It's expensive. This is not a cheap place. You know, our staff want five-star accommodation for one-star prices. And when when they think of bringing, so they can find places, you know, I'm talking about just the practical measure. And our staff think they own Glen Eyrie but don't want to pay for it. And this place is an expensive thing to. Jack McQueenie just goes, no, they broke even last year. This year we're moving, but that has nothing to do with the capital investor and all that sort of thing. There's no way in the world that Glen Eyrie can pay for itself when you've got a 40% occupancy rate for the year. Because you can't have, this is basically a summer conference. It's filled totally from May 15 to September 15, but only filled about 20% or less in between. And so how much staff do you keep on? What do you do? It's really a nightmare to keep this functioning. And it's just an issue of cost. That's one of the... Pardon me? Yeah. Yeah, it is. And that's why we're trying to raise a $6 million endowment for the maintenance of Glen Eyrie. Because we know that the fees that they can charge, if they charge what it really cost here, nobody would come. It's like any product. There's a certain level that you can charge for it, and you go above it and you start losing, you go below it and you can't support it. So it's one of those.
How are you trying to raise the money, Jerry?
Pardon me?
How?
Mostly from individuals and people. Well, we haven't done a mailing because it's a larger amount, and we feel that there are some people, John, who have a special interest, whose lives have been changed at Glen Eyrie. I went and made one presentation to some of our very close friends in another state, and they didn't. Now the son has kind of taken over this foundation, and he doesn't have the history that his parents had. Then he looks at it, well, why don't you just sell it? You know, oh, you can't do that. I don't see how you can do that. He looked at, and so I said, we laughed, and I said, even though they're very good friends, I said, that's it. See, people generally, now college, they understand putting money into a building. I don't know why, but they do. But not many would, you know, they're only a small universe of people who see the need for keeping this facility. Now, I will tell you honestly, we don't need Glen Eyrie to do the Navigator's Ministry worldwide. We needed it in 56 through 70 because we did all of our training here. But I will tell you that when Okori and those guys come back, this is an emotional home to them. This is a symbol of history. And some of our board members, every time, once in a while, someone say, well, let's sell the Glen Eyrie. They say, I want off the board before you do that. You know, so it's kind of that balance. But we feel there are some people who will have a heart for putting in, you know, several hundred thousand dollars into that, but have not felt that we should do it on a, we have a major capital campaign going on in there, but there is, they can designate it towards certain things, and Glen Eyrie is one of them.
If a person leaves money, or leaves something at will, mm-hmm. when it goes to the Navigators, how is that distributed?
It depends on what they put in their will.
If it's just open.
If it's open, then the leadership team would probably decide where it should go. The most likely, part of it could go to Glen Eyrie. Some would probably go into, we've got a health care fund, you know, we're self-insured in the Navigators, and that's one of the major costs. One of our staff recruiting problems is that the health care is so expensive, and we've had days of prayer on this, and that for a staff to come on, the first about $800 a month that they raise goes to health care.
That's not different from anybody else.
No,
though,
no, it isn't. But they have to raise it, see. So that person says, you know what, this is a big nut to crack, so what we're doing a health care fund where when a new staff comes on, we'll pick up half of his health insurance for the first year, then maybe 40% for this. Do you see what I mean? We're going to try and ease that burden as they come in and to have a special fund put aside.
It's still self-funded, isn't it? I mean, you don't...
Yeah, it's totally self-funded with an umbrella cap. And so it's totally experience related. Yeah, there's a stop loss, yeah.
Is there times when this location and all places not like shut down? Is there a season when there's nothing going on here?
Yeah, between Christmas and New Year's generally.
Oh, this year.
Yeah, and what they've had to do for even the lawn mowing, we used to keep staff because the staff would come here for training and they'd be paid $20 a week. But then they said, no, you got to pay a minimum wage. As soon as they did that, it killed, I mean, legally. And so, you know, the staff trainees would be out taking care of the lawns and doing the maintenance, and there's all kinds of jokes and things of our history on that. I've come down, chopped ice, and done all kinds of things down here. Can't do that anymore by law. We're 501c3.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Ken Carr took us over to Focus on the Family.
Uh-huh.
And they were explaining to us about their new 501c4, which is now made it possible for them to have Focus on the Family action.
Yeah, that's what Jim's doing. Political action group, yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. It's also risky. Yeah, I'm involved in something that Ken and I would know, the Air Force Association. We're changing the Air Force Association, which has 120,000 members, to a 501c3 from a 501c19, which is a veterans organization.
But a C4 is not the same as a political organization.
Uh-huh.
They do not participate in politics.
But it's lobbying, right?
They advocate.
Is yours a 501c4?
Well, we've got one of everything. We've got a C3, a C4, and a PAC. Now, the PAC is the political.
Okay. Well,
but the C4 yeah. is not deductible.
Yeah, a Christian ministry has to be very careful on confusion of names and, you know, and so forth. It's because they're, that's tough. Well, listen, our time is up. I hope this helps. If you have some suggestions on what we might do a little better and different, I'm just trying to just describe it the way I do it and the way I think all of our staff do it. You got a little bit of a corporate overview, but, you know.
How will a fellow like Mike Trenier be able to handle it? This is a totally different thing than he's ever experienced.
Yeah.
Kenya.
I know. Well, it's a little, he ran all of Africa, and it's tough. He's scared on two things. And I said, I'll help bridge him. Now, see, I've got a deal. I've got to be sure I don't get in the way. I got to not be in the way. He said, so they have to run. I don't sit on the executive team meetings anymore as of January 1st. He's concerned about the financial implications of raising the money more broadly, as I've done, tried to do quite a bit of. And for the international office, you know, for our team in which Dave and I serve on. And secondly, the broader connections into the Christian community. Mike doesn't have those because he's been, especially an American. So what I told him, I said, okay, let's take 2 years. I'll take you to the key things that you really need, but don't do anything that you don't need to do. In other words, let's not just go to meetings to meet people. There's too much that he has to do to connect the work. But boy, he has so much more going for him in terms of support than I had when I came into it. We didn't have an easy 4 or 5 years at the beginning. You know, just, it wasn't easy because we made a lot of changes. But wouldn't you say, Jack, that the momentum is pretty good out there for Mike? And I'm so thrilled. And the reason I stepped out at this time is because of Mike's age. And that if I didn't, he needs a good 10-year run at it. And so I figured I'd better get out of the way. So, well, let me pray for us. Father, thanks for this time. I thank you for these folks. Help us to better know and understand what you've called us, the navigators, to do. And to learn to do much of it ourselves. So keep us connected with what really is going on at the grassroots, and not to get caught up in just big numbers, but to do those day-by-day things that you've called us to do. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, folks.